Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hughes Smith. He's author, leading blog, and financer. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy. Also a recent book called Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. And now, most recently, is another book called Will You Be Richer or Poorer? Profit, Power, and AI in the Traumatized World. And that's what we'd like to focus on today, is that book. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate your willingness to discuss the book.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And you take a very macro look at the world, the economy, political systems, how capitalism has evolved, and distilled it down to the personal level. So basically the question is, will you be richer or poorer? But then you go and define and highlight that there's different kinds of wealth, and many of that ignores many costs as well. One reason is our economy doesn't even measure many kinds of wealth and ignores many costs. So your initial thoughts?
Yeah, what I wanted to do in this book was try to make explicit a lot of forms of wealth and capital that we sort of implicitly understand have value, but we don't really measure it or include it in our sort of balance sheets of our economy or even of our own households. And so I think when I look at the stage of the global economy that we're in right now, you see a degradation of what we call natural capital, right? Like the biosphere and certain resources, like, you know, the seas, the oceans, that have been heavily impacted, you know, kind of overfishing and that kind of thing. And then we also have like our social capital, like our ability to get problems resolved, to find middle ground, and also these sort of intangibles, such as social mobility, you know, the opportunities that are available to everybody in society, and our sort of general sense of economic security. Like, are we really, do we feel that everybody that's participating in our society is becoming more financially secure, or are they actually like falling behind or losing ground? And all of this kind of discussion is lost if we're just going to look at financial wealth. Like, okay, you know, the U.S., for example, has something like $100 trillion in total financial wealth, but much of that is held by a small group at the top of the wealth power pyramid. So, is that really, what are we losing intangibly in that kind of setup? So that was kind of my starting point. And I that eventually leads to the question of where should you invest your own capital? And by that, I mean, not just your financial, you know, capital, your money, but also, you know, your human capital and your social capital. Like, where can you get not only a return on your capital, but also in a place where you can control it. And so this kind of leads into a discussion about different business models and maybe getting away from this sort of very concentrated wealth, IPO, venture capital, financialization that's dominated the economy, you know, globally over the last 20 years.
Very interesting. And so basically the book centers around three questions. What if everything we don't measure is worth more than financial wealth? Our obsession with financial capital is blinding us to a traumatizing global decline in other forms of wealth. as you recently referenced. And will artificial intelligence, AI, make us all richer? What if AI will only enrich the few who own the platforms and the technology? And the third question is our economic model dooming us? We're told we all benefit as the super rich get even richer, but what if the status quo only benefits those in power at the expense of everyone else and our planet? So I guess if you want to break down your thoughts on each of those three questions, that'd be great.
Yeah, I sort of talked about looking at intangible capital, which it includes intellectual capital and social capital, and the ability of our society, if you will, to adapt successfully, as resources get squeezed by just the endless growth story is really running up against limits. You know, there's not enough lithium at affordable prices to, say, replace all of the hydrocarbons we burn. You know, these kinds of limitations are now appearing, right? It's not infinite, and there's the costs that go into doing things such as mining lithium are generally not accounted for. In other words, if we lived downstream from a gigantic lithium mine, we'd find maybe our water's been poisoned by all the all the tailings from the mine, and there's degradation on a bunch of different fronts that aren't really included in our calculation of how we're going to move from hydrocarbons to this sort of wonderful future of AI and alternative energy. And so we really need to do a better accounting, is what I'm suggesting, of all the costs and all the forms of wealth that are being lost, really, in the current model. So the second question is, a lot of people are placing a tremendous amount of faith in AI and robotics. And their general belief is that these technologies are going to do virtually all of human work. You know, they're going to perform all of the labor that humans have been doing. And as a result, they're going to make us all extremely wealthy because they'll be doing all the work. And we can just kind of sit back and enjoy the fruits of their labor. And I question that based on a couple of factors. One is, if you look at technology as it actually works in the real world, you discover that when it's financialized and commoditized, the profit margins actually decline. And so, China being the workshop of the world, the technology that's made there, whether it's commodity semiconductors and other technological parts, the profit margins are just razor thin. And some estimates of what actually ends up in the Chinese company's hands from making or assembling an iPhone is on the order of $10 to $15, out of a $300 or $400 phone. So just because the technology exists doesn't mean it's going to be highly profitable. In general, it's only profitable when it's new and there's sort of a monopoly. And then once it's been commoditized and made around the world, then the profit margins fall. So, and the other question I have is, right now, the quality and durability of a great many artificial intelligence, high-tech kinds of appliances and devices is actually very poor. My example is just like your standard washer and dryer, which all have a circuit board now that's the controlling board. And those things fail with great regularity. In fact, they usually fail within a few years. That's been my experience. And the parts cost about half the cost of the whole appliance. And so here we are imagining this wonderful world where robots do all the work, and yet we seem to be overlooking the practicalities that the technology that we do have fails at a tremendous rate, and the durability is really poor. So I could see a future in which the robots and the AI devices end up in the landfill along with all the washers and dryers with defective controller boards. So again, it's one of those things that we all hope for magic, you know, and so we're all hoping that AI and robotics are some sort of magic, but in the real world, they're really expensive, capital intensive, and they fail on this principle. No device is any more durable than its lowest quality component. And so the more thousands of components you put into a device, the more likely it is that one of them will fail. So there's limits on that kind of model, I think, of AI and robotics doing all the work. And the last one is our economic model dooming us. And I think as before we started recording, we were discussing the idea that we're in like late stage capitalism, where it's been largely based on financialization over the last 20 years. And this is to some degree global, where the big profits are made by financializing stuff that used to be safe, like, for instance, mortgages, and then using debt and leverage to create new financial instruments that can then be sold. And we've gotten away from any sense of ethics that enterprise is supposed to serve society, and that the point of capitalism is to distribute capital to maximize productivity increases and efficiencies that would benefit society as a whole. And I think the example of where we've gone wrong is the recent example is WeWork, right? This model that was losing billions of dollars, claiming to be a tech company when it really wasn't. And it turns out that it was, if not an out and out fraud, something very similar to a fraud. And yet the founder walks off with $1 billion. And after basically creating zero value for his customers, employees, and investors. So that's, I think, the model that we seem to be on to a very large degree. And so the question is, what other business models are there out there that could actually become sustainable, you know, in a resource limited world?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. And the book mentions intangible capital. So how does that come into play into this? Like, how is it accounted for?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Richard. And I think that, again, like the intangible capital includes institutions with checks and balances. In other words, part of why advanced capitalism has worked well is that there are checks and balances, meaning that it's required for companies to be transparent about their finances. And people, investors can question the board of directors and these kinds of checks and balances where and investors have a choice about where to put their money. And so if this system is functioning properly, it enforces transparency and consequences for misbehavior or malinvestment, then that's a form of intangible capital, that sort of structure, right? And when you lose that structure and you end up with a very corrupt system, then you lose a tremendous amount of capital, you know, that may not be visible, but you lose the ability to solve problems, to adapt successfully and that kind of thing. And of course, socially, I'm afraid, and many other people share my concern that we're losing the intangible capital of systems like social mobility, like the idea that you can access capital, both financial and social capital, and start a business yourself. For instance, that's becoming so difficult and so costly that that's no longer an option for many people. And that's, of course, part of the vitality of capitalism is that the barriers to entry have to be low enough that a lot of people can throw their hat in the ring, so to speak. And that's where you get innovation in the that can scale to size, but it can also just remain local and still add value to its community. So those are examples of the intangible capital that I think has been eroded by the current model.
Interesting. And you've got a section in the book that talks about new relationships between capital, labor, and the natural world. And you go into some detail on incentives to designing a better system. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's, I guess you could start, I could start by saying my concern is if somebody comes up with a, you know, so-called better mousetrap, right, which today might be a new form of machine learning or something, it's very likely to be bought out or bought up by some monopoly or quasi-monopoly platform such as Facebook or Google, and then buried in their platform, or used to increase their own monopoly, if you will, right, to create a higher barrier of entry to protecting their monopoly. And so that is not the ideal system, obviously. What we want is disruption. And so if the current power structure is so powerful and so limiting that disruption is not really possible anymore, then I think then that's a limiting factor. So what we want is we want to redistribute capital so it's available across the much broader spectrum, right? And right now, most of the capital, as we all know from central banks, flows to a handful of large banks and financiers and corporations, right? And so the average like young entrepreneur can't go get, you know, $100 million from the Federal Reserve, right? And so I think the idea, the goal should be to distribute capital, both intellectual capital and also social capital, but also the means to access financial capital should be broadened, decentralized. That's where you can get the innovation and the disruption that we need to move forward. And so before we started recording, we were talking about there's a sort of emergence because of the internet and cryptocurrencies and other innovations of different models for funding companies and possibly different methodologies for deciding where to invest.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. We were discussing that. And the one of the approaches that we've taken is actually use some of the principles from the Austrian school of economics, which emphasizes savings and investment and, emphasizes as well the value of minimal or manageable debt, minimal leverage, zero leverage or minimal leverage, and also factors involved with promoting entrepreneurialism, innovation. And so, some of the ways that are evolving in the marketplace in terms of investment asset model portfolios is a move towards emphasizing those factors and translating them into so-called smart beta factors, many of which are correlated with stock market outperformance at lower risk. And all of that also ties in with these green type of initiatives, like looking at the very strong corporate social responsibility programs and factors that are related to environment, social, and governance, ESG factors, that companies will look at and look at promoting. And then there's also international standards like GRI standards that will measure and assess the effectiveness and the success of these initiatives, programs, and applicability to factors. So it all goes towards being able to identify companies like where you would want to put your money in terms of being able to promote companies that are, you know, good to the environment, promoting environmental type of development in a positive direction, as well as social factors, governance, corporate governance overall. But it's also correlated with stock market outperformance, so that the actual company equity is likely to go higher. Your thoughts?
Yeah. And so I think that's the kind of thing that I was speaking about in the book when I talk about incentives to designing a better system. So I wonder if it doesn't tie into our previous conversations here on the millennial generation. And we could even, I think, bring in Gen Z, the generation coming up behind the millennials, that perhaps we need a new sort of ethical standard for investing, so that as the younger generation start taking over, inheriting the capital or gaining control as professional managers or family wealth managers, a different standard for what qualifies as an investment. And, you know, just to take a physical example we can all relate to, there's, you know, forestry, right? You can own a forest and you can manage it in a number of different ways. And of course, the old model was you clear cut it, right? That's the quickest short-term profit is you basically chop down all the mature trees and sell that at the highest possible price, and then you move on. And the new model is, of course, to manage the forest sustainably. So you're only taking out, you know, say if it's a 40-year growth cycle, you're only taking out 1/40th of the mature trees at any one time, and you're attempting to maintain the biosphere of the whole forest. You're not just creating a monoculture of planting this, you know, the same tree over, you know, 1,000 or acres. And so these kinds of like sustainable forestry companies can actually be profitable, right? They may not be quite as profitable in the short term, but in the longer term, they can serve their community by creating like permanent jobs instead of this sort of, you know, sporadic short-term thing where you go in and you need a bunch of people to strip mine the forest, and then they're all laid off and they've got no work. So it's really clear that there are better models available, but the incentives have to be there. And so the system, you know, the model portfolios you're talking about, those are the kinds of things that do create an incentive. In other words, we people can earn a return on their capital, but they can do so in good conscience and serve the needs of labor for jobs, and also create like models, and often using technology such as, you know, drone sensor software and so on to manage resources in a way that's actually sustainable, instead of just like stripping them and then moving on, which has been the model for sadly for a couple hundred years.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the last section of your book, you go into where will your capital flourish. So you look at assessing our current wealth, richer or poorer. How would one decide if the level of the wealth of an individual is richer or poorer, taking all forms of capital into consideration?
Right. Well, you know, Richard, actually part of this section was inspired by our conversations on what the millennial generation might be able to do in terms of where they're going to invest their time and energy, right, in for their own benefit, as well as for the benefit of society. And we talked about the possibility of working in new business models that give each worker, you know, more flexibility and more entrepreneurial control, and possibly moving to places where there's a more decentralized economy with more opportunities than there are in like the big cities that are so high cost that it's very difficult to be an entrepreneur. So I think my question, where will your capital flourish? My idea was to sort of ask each reader to go through their own capital, which includes their social contacts, you know, their network of colleagues and collaborators, their skill sets, you know, like what skills they can apply, but maybe they're not able to use in their current employment. So they might have a lot of skills and intellectual capital that's languishing, that could create value, but they're not in a position where they're able to use it to create value. And then just the actual physical locale, like, are you in an economy that's vibrant? In other words, that there's a lot of capital available, not just financial capital, but there's social capital. Like, there's other people with ideas that can help you. There's people that want to cooperate and collaborate. And we all know what that feels like, right? That there's a ferment and an excitement when an economy is decentralized and there's opportunity for people across an entire spectrum, not just wealthy people or people who, you know, are over-credentialed, but even just regular folks have opportunities, right? That's a much more vibrant economy. So where will your capital flourish? It's asking a question about where will your intellectual capital flourish, as well as where will your opportunities be the largest, and where will you be able to maintain the most control over your capital? Because I think one of the points I'm hoping to stress here is that, you know, we've gotten into this model where you sort of passively put your money in some index fund or a passive fund, and it's actually exposed to all sorts of systemic risks that you may not be aware of. But more importantly, you don't really control that capital, right? You're not able to really manage it to your own best benefit or to the benefit of society. And so I think the first move when you say, where will my capital flourish, is the first move is to take control of your capital. Don't be passive. And once you're an active manager of your own capital, then you're much more likely to get returns that are satisfying to you as well as, you know, sustainable.
And overall, in terms of the migration of this towards your vision, is this something that needs to be encouraged by governments through regulation, or do you see this as an evolving process just from natural forces?
Well, that's an excellent question, Richard. And, you know, the history of government regulation is mixed, as we all know. In some cases, such as fire safety regulations, it pays huge dividends to, you know, the public interest, right? To make sure that public buildings have enough exits and so on. But when it gets to, say, minimum wage and extreme regulations on where businesses can operate and how they operate, then it doesn't necessarily create any value for the public good. It's basically just churning away money, you know, that goes to, you know, bureaucrats and regulators and not really benefiting the public. And so I think we're going to have to look at regulations that sort of protect every participant in the economy, right? That you want to avoid situations where people can be exploited and so on. So you want to protect people from exploitation and danger. But other than that, I think the regulation should be focused on encouraging experimentation, adaptation, and innovation, right? And there are some local governments that get it, right? That are trying to make it easy to start businesses with like a one-stop permit process and lowering the cost of permits for operating businesses and loosening up regulations concerning zoning and so on, so you could actually legally operate a business from your home. This is the kind of regulation that I think is forward-looking.
And do you think that would come about through crash and burn of the existing system, you know, just getting ultimately worse and then finally crashing, or you know, insightful thought and careful planning, discussion, and sort of adapting what the current system is more towards in the direction of your vision?
Yeah, it's a good question. And of course, crash and burn crisis is where people will finally let go of old models, right? And that's sadly, you know, we tend to conserve what we think has worked well in the past. And so we're very hesitant to let go of stuff that we think has worked well. So crash and burn is and crisis is in some ways the fastest way to adapt, because it's kind of the analogous to a forest fire. When the fire burns everything down, then you can finally get new growth, right? But even with existing, you know, structures, if cities start seeing and local authorities, if you will, if they start seeing their local economies stagnate and decline, then they might be motivated enough to attempt to encourage the innovation that they desperately need. And that's there are some encouraging signs around that. So, but it depends on having forward-looking public officials that will work with private sector, as opposed to viewing them private sector as the tax donkey or the enemy.
And do you think overall does the perception of different types of capital and the measurement of that type of wealth in terms of different kinds of wealth, and do you think that is also culturally related in terms of cultural factors and could necessitate a change in the way we – in our culture?
Well, that's a very insightful question, Richard. And one of the examples I use in the book is you can be extremely wealthy in financial terms in a country with terrible air and water quality. And of course, we all know there's plenty of examples of that around the world where the rich person's breathing the same horrible air as the poor person. And so in a way that the capital that so many people value includes a transparent legal system, you know, that's a level playing field, clean air and water, and opportunity for their children, low cost education. I mean, there's all these forms of wealth that are accessible in the developed world, and that are inaccessible in lesser developed places where there's extremely corrupt governance and really poor air and water quality, poor opportunities for your children, and so on. And so this, of course, is why so many people are trying to migrate to the developed world, where these forms of capital are accessible to virtually every participant, right? And you don't have to be wealthy to breathe, you know, clean air. And so that should be our goal, obviously, to extend that kind of capital to elsewhere. But for each of us as individuals and our household, then I think it's a good exercise to say, look at all of our forms of capital, which includes our circle of friends, our opportunities in the place where we live, the opportunities for our children, and our access to social capital in terms of like public places, and sharing of knowledge, you know, libraries, the internet, this kind of thing. So if you look at all forms of capital, I think you might be impressed with how much wealth we all have in the developed world. And we understand why the depth of the poverty of many undeveloped or developing world places that lack these basic forms of shared capital.
Wow, that's fantastic insight. And this book will help you identify the things that truly matter and accumulate capital that benefits you and your family and our planet. The book is called Will You Be Richer or Poorer, Profit, Power, and AI in a Traumatized World? Thank you very much, Charles.
Hey, I appreciate your willingness to discuss these somewhat abstract concepts, Richard. Really appreciate it.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.